You're listening to Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, we take a look at the historic gains for low-income workers during the pandemic and why the current fight against inflation may reverse those gains. But now, military officials say Ukraine is preparing for a counteroffensive against the Russian invasion. Some are speculating that it may have already started. President Volodymyr Zelensky has not announced the launch of a formal campaign to push back Russia's front line, but reports say Ukrainian commanders are shifting to offensive actions and sending in some heavy machinery to eastern regions of the country. Still, Ukraine has not committed its main forces to the battle, as reported, raising questions about the country's current military strategy and its strengths. All of this comes as a major dam in southern Ukraine collapsed yesterday, and both sides of the conflict are blaming each other for its destruction and the people's lives who are now in peril because of it. We want to hear what you think at 1-800-642-1234. Let us know about your opinion on the current situation in Ukraine and Russia's involvement in it. Do you think it's time for Ukraine to launch its counteroffensive? And what role should the U.S. be playing, if any? 1-800-642-1234 to join us. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Andrew Kidd is a professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He specializes in international relations, armed conflict, and political violence. And Andy, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, and let's start with the Kakhovka Dam in Kherson, and you've got people reportedly on roofs asking to be rescued, and finger pointing going both ways. From afar, from all the way back here in the United States, how are you to make sense? How can we best make sense of this ongoing human tragedy that's happening right now?
Well, I guess there's a couple of ways to approach it. One is the question of who did it, and then there's the question of what the effects are going to be. I think it's overwhelmingly likely that the Russians are the one who blew up the dam, both from a sort of technical perspective, and that it would have been much easier for them to do it because they were in control of the dam physically at the time, and also in terms of motivation to do it. We're seeing the first steps of this long-awaited offensive on the Ukrainian side, and it seems fairly likely that the Russians planned this demolition of the dam as a both response to that in terms of saying, well, we can inflict casualties on you if you keep on attacking us, and also to try to divert resources from the war effort towards this humanitarian relief effort that's going to have to follow in the result of the dam being blown up and the flooding that's happening downstream.
Yeah, so as we look at that, what's happening right now there, the other story that's popped up recently is the U.S. intelligence getting a heads up on the Nord Stream pipeline and a plan that the Ukrainians had to blow up this pipeline last year. But the president, Volodymyr Zelensky, has said today that Ukraine was not behind the series of underwater explosions that crippled the Nord Stream gas pipelines in September. How do we begin to make sense of something like that?
Yeah, that's an interesting comparison. I've thought about that a little bit recently as well. It never made a lot of sense that the Russians would blow up their own pipeline. So I was actually somewhat skeptical that it was Russia behind it when that blew up. And I thought it was fairly difficult or unlikely that the Ukrainians did it simply for logistical reasons. But as you say, leaks that came out through this Discord leak that surfaced recently indicate that the Ukrainians at least had a plan to do it, which has a certain resemblance to the events as they actually unfolded. So that certainly raises your sort of estimate of the likelihood that it was Ukraine that did it. I always thought it might be someone more local to the scene who was also hostile to Russia, one of the Baltic states, for instance, that might have done it. It's certainly possible that it was Ukrainian saboteurs who did that. I think that's a bit different from this case, though, in terms of the main downside or risk for the Ukrainians in attacking the Nord Stream would be if it was discovered and proved that they had done it, then that would have, you know, made the Europeans and particularly the Germans mad at them and jeopardized their support. Whereas in this case, in the case of the Kakhovka Dam, you're talking about, hundreds of square miles of territory that's been inundated. Tens of thousands of people who have to evacuate their homes. Their homes are going to be have to be destroyed in the end. Lives will be lost. Croplands won't be irrigated. So the cost on the Ukrainian side is enormous. And it's not clear what the benefit would be in terms of advantaging the Ukrainian side. So I think it's just extremely unlikely that the Ukrainians did it in this case.
The dam that was holding back the Dnipro River in Ukraine, Kherson there, also was involved in keeping a cooling pool, as I understand it, for the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant. Is there reason to be concerned about the future of that power plant as you see it, Andrew?
Well, there's going to be reason to be concerned about that as long as it's in Russian hands. In terms of the immediate short-term future, there isn't. There's somewhat more reason, but not enormous reason, in the sense that they have a cooling pond that is still intact for the power plant itself, which they can draw upon to cool the plant for the foreseeable future in terms of, you know, months looking ahead. That there's no immediate risk of a meltdown or anything serious like that. And they've shut down much of the plant, so the need for cooling waters has been reduced considerably. So in the short term, we're not worried about that, you know, barring any further Russian activity to sabotage or blow up or disable the plant in some way. There is a possibility, of course, that as part of this summer offensive, that there's going to be fighting in that region. The region of the power plant. It's upstream of that dam that was just blown up, and it's on the path essentially from the Ukrainian-Russian front lines as they exist today to the Black Sea or the Azov Sea coast that the Ukrainians might be hoping to eventually reach in order to try to cut off Russian access to Crimea and all the forces to the west of that point. And so it might see further fighting in the future or at least be, you know, in the vicinity of fighting.
Andy Kidd, our guest, political science professor at UW-Madison, taking a look at the Russian war in Ukraine 15 months in. And what are the international rules about things like blowing up dams or blowing up pipelines? And is it rules be damned when it comes to wars like these, Andy?
Well, rules be damned is sort of a good pun in this case. So in the past, you know, dams were blown up in wars in World War II. The dam across further upstream on the Dnieper River was blown up by the Russians when the Germans were coming in. And then the Germans repaired it a little bit and then blew it up again on their way out in 1943. So, and of course, there was the famous raid by British bombers on German dams in the Ruhr Valley. So that's happened in the past. However, that's now been deemed to be, you know, contravention to the laws of war as they were codified in about 1949. So blowing up big civilian infrastructure projects like dams is now deemed to be against the laws of war. So that's been pointed out means that the people who did this may face a liability if Russia loses the war and if they are eventually turned in or become subject to international prosecution. The pipeline is an interesting case. That might be another, I'm not sure if that would qualify in the sense because you're not targeting civilian lives directly. It's a pipeline at the bottom of the ocean. There's environmental consequences, of course, in terms of pollution. So whether that would qualify as a violation of the laws of war is something I'm not as certain about that as the case of the dams.
Andy, how are we to assess whether or not the counteroffensive from Ukraine has even begun against Russian forces? Russian Defense Ministry said a couple days ago it had already thwarted a major Ukrainian attack in the Donetsk region, killing 300 troops and destroying 16 tanks, but that has not been verified. How do we go about figuring out what's actually happening through this fog of war?
Well, I think what we're seeing now is a transition from the defensive phase of the war, more or less static along most of the front, with some defensive operations around Bakhmut, which gradually fell to the Russians, culminating last month in May, to a phase where the Ukrainians are going to be on the offensive. And you're seeing that in various locations along the front. Interestingly, a lot of the sources that were very forthcoming with where the Russians are attacking are not quite as forthcoming when it comes to where the Ukrainians are attacking. essentially because they're sort of heeding Ukrainian pleas for operational security and secrecy about where their forces are moving. But I think what we're seeing is sort of the overture, if you will, of the summer offensive, the spring or summer offensive, depending on how you want to think of it now. That is, the Ukrainians are attacking here and there, looking for weak points, trying to fake the Russians out. They don't want to just attack in a huge manner at one particular location that put all their eggs in that basket. They probably have very good intelligence about where Russian forces are, but they... by attacking here and there, they can keep the Russians off balance and look for a point where the Russians may be weaker than they would be somewhere else, and try to draw Russian forces away from whatever their main axis of advance is going to be, or attempted axis of advance is going to be. And they face the issue that everybody sort of knows, that it would be extremely advantageous for the Ukrainians to, as I mentioned, strike south to the Sea of Azov and cut the Russian forces off. And so that overall strategic objective seems pretty clear, and there's only a sort of limited number of axes you can take to get there. So the Russians can pretty easily sort of anticipate that. But there's enough leeway there to try to fake the Russians out about exactly where you're going to go and what routes you're going to take. And so they're probably trying to play that game now and lure the Russians off balance and get them where they would not be in the way.
We're talking with UW-Madison political science professor Andy Kidd about a upcoming counteroffensive from Ukraine against Russia's invasion, and you can join with your questions. Do you support a counteroffensive from Ukraine against Russia? 1-800-642-1234. How much should the U.S. be involved as you see it? And what questions do you have about where things stand in Ukraine right now and what we can expect going forward? Ask our expert. Join us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Our conversation continues coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're picking up our talk with Andy Kidd. He's a political science professor at UW-Madison who researches armed conflict as well as international relations, and he's with us to discuss the latest on Russia's war in Ukraine and a potential counteroffensive against the invasion. You can join us. What questions do you have about Ukraine's military strategy here, and how much involvement do you think the U.S. should have in supporting the fight back against Russia? 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. And Andy, how significant are the U.S. and NATO interests in the success or failure of the counteroffensive, and what is the investment of U.S. and NATO right now and going forward?
Well, I think our interests are pretty significant in the success of Ukraine's effort to defend itself against Russian aggression here. I mean, this war that started last year in February of 2022 was just an outright invasion by Russia of their neighboring country, Ukraine, with an attempt to overthrow the government and reincorporate it into a broader Russian empire, which Putin, I think, has been missing ever since the collapse of the Soviet Union. Back in 1991. So I think the stakes are incredibly high. If he were to succeed in doing that, then who knows where he would turn next, right? The eastern border of NATO would be then under threat from a renewed aggressive Russian dictatorship that has had enormous success in the face of weakness. So I think standing up to Putin is very important, very much in the Western interests, both the Europeans and the United States. I mean, the question you need to ask yourself is, where do you want to fight Russia? In Ukraine, where do you want to stop them, essentially? Do you want to just let them become as strong as they were back in the Cold War, and so we're fighting them on the German border, or containing them on the German border? Or do you want to stop them here? So I think it's very much in our interest to stop them where they are. And how we've been helping them? Yes, absolutely. We've been giving them increasingly sophisticated weapons. Key weapons back in the early going were the anti-tank weapons that helped them blunt the Russian offensive. Then we've heard about the HIMARS, the long-range rocket systems that enable them to strike a little bit further behind enemy lines. And we've been helping them with training. We've been helping them with equipping their new armored units that are going to be used in this offensive. So have the British, so have the Germans. They've been using Leopard armored vehicles from Germany, the Challengers from the UK, and they're going to get some Abrams tanks from the United States, Patriot anti-aircraft missile systems, anti-missile systems. So we've been helping them in a myriad of ways. And they've been using that very successfully. And I think that's the key difference between this conflict and conflicts in recent memory that the United States was involved in Afghanistan, for instance, and Iraq. Whereas in this case, the Ukrainians are eager recipients, eager users and adept users of everything we give them and doing all the fighting themselves. Whereas in the previous cases, that was not the case. We would supply and train units and then they would melt away and desert and collapse and whatnot. And we were dealing with governments and units that were corrupt or less interested in fighting than would have been good for the cause. So in this case, the Ukrainians are doing the fighting, they're doing the dying, and we're helping them defend their country against an outright Russian aggression. So I think it's well worthwhile.
We spoke with you, Andy, on this show about the Russian war in Ukraine almost exactly a year ago when the war was just about 3 months old. A year later, what surprises you about where we are today, and what does that portend for what we can expect next?
I was somewhat favorably surprised by the offensives on the Ukrainian side last fall that regained a fair amount of territory in the north near Kharkiv and in the south, culminating when they recaptured Kherson along the Dnieper River. I thought that boded pretty well in terms of the Ukrainians still weren't that well equipped with Western weapons overall, and yet they were driving the Russians back in important operations. So that was pretty favorably surprising. And I think what the big question is, what's going to happen this summer? An offensive is coming. How successful will it be? Will they really achieve some big strategic success and get to the Sea of Azov? Who knows what could happen? I think if the Ukrainians were able to make some significant gains and take back a bunch of territory and give good promise that they were, worthy recipients of aid and making good use of it, then I think that's all to the good. If they weren't, if the Russians actually turned the tables and started making gains of their own, that would be disappointing. I think it's unlikely given the enormous investment the Russians made to try to take Bakhmut and the relatively small gains that they made as a result of that. So I think the initiative is all on the Ukrainian side at this point. And so we'll just have to see what happens in the next couple of months.
Andy Kidd, political science professor at UW-Madison, who specializes in international relations, armed conflict, and political violence. What do you make of some of the attacks we've seen into the borders of Russia? Although they've been small and they've been few in number, does that surprise you at all?
It's a little bit surprising, but I wouldn't pay too much attention to it. I think it's mostly a kind of a sideshow and a diversion. These are sort of Russian dissidents of one form or another, in some cases far-right neo-Nazi types, who are kind of piggybacking and taking advantage of this conflict to try to work out some of their animosity towards Putin, who kicked them out of Russia earlier, and they sort of circled back and ended up in Ukraine because that was one way they could get back at Russia or the Russian government, the Putin government. But I don't think they're militarily significant. I don't think they're going to have any serious effect on the tide of war in this case. It's mostly a political theater and kind of a sideshow.
Is there a way to resolve this conflict and find peace with Russia, with Vladimir Putin still in control of Russia?
Yeah, if he's defeated. I mean, I think it's conceivable, and the goal that ought to be pursued is to liberate Ukrainian territory and reestablish the Ukrainian borders as they were before 2014. If that goal is achieved, then I think the war comes to an end. Putin, even if Putin is in power, if he's not in power, that's great. If he is still in power, there won't be much he can do. He could still attack across the border. He could try to launch air raids or whatnot. But I think at that point, the war will be basically over and the Ukrainians will have won. So what happens to Putin after that? Some people think he can't retain power after such a humiliating defeat. That might be the case, but I think it's of lesser importance to the Ukrainian side.
Andrew Kidd, political science professor at UW-Madison. Still time for you at 1-800-642-1234. And with this situation, all the world's eyes watching the potential for a counter, expectations of a counteroffensive. Andy, what are you watching for next?
Well, I mean, the big question is, where are they going to strike exactly? And how they're going to do it. Are they really going to go for the southern strategy? Are they going to push more northern and eastern in Donetsk? So where the attack is going to happen? And the big question is, can they get through these Russian lines, right? The Russians have been building fortified lines for 6 months to a year now, laying these concrete so-called dragon's teeth, digging anti-tank ditches, laying mines and whatnot. And the question is, are the Ukrainians going to be able to punch through those fortifications and restore mobility? And if they can, then it's kind of all up for the Russians. But if the Russians are able to capably defend those fortified positions, then it could be very slow going. And the Ukrainians will have to pay a lot for the advances that they make.
Andy, I want to thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Andy Kidd is professor of political science, at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where he specializes in armed conflict, international relations, and political violence. With us today to discuss the latest out of the war in Ukraine and the stakes involved in a counteroffensive against Russia. We want to invite you to continue this conversation and ask your questions or give us your comments at ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Let us know what you know, what you think, and what we can expect next. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, Kate Archer Kent gets some perspective on social media from Beloit High School students, as well as a pediatrician who leads the social media and adolescent health research team at UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. And Kate Archer Kent also talks to the author of On Loneliness, How to Feel Less Alone in an Isolating World. Terry Laxton Brooks explains how loneliness can be a source of growth and provide new opportunities for connections. That's The Morning Show, weekdays from 7 to 9 on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today. And coming up, we learn from a UW... Oh, I'm sorry. We have the UW economist with us. And we will find out more about the end of pandemic policies and how they could jeopardize historic gains for low-income workers over the last few years. But first, it's time for Wisconsin Life. And here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about an evolving city.
Cities inevitably change through the decades. People move in and out. Businesses come and go. Oftentimes, these shifts are the most obvious in your own neighborhood. Author and historian John Gerda has been reflecting on changes surrounding his childhood home in Milwaukee. He talks about how waves of immigration continue adding to the rich history of this beloved neighborhood.
I've decided what I want to be when I retire. Not a teller of cautionary tales to the young, not an ache-by-ache chronicler of my ongoing deterioration, and not, heaven forbid, a golfer. What I want to be is something much simpler, an old guy on a bike who rides around looking at things. I might stop once in a while to buy a donut, raise a glass of beer, or fall into casual conversation, but I'll mainly be a witness to change, content to observe the passing scene and enjoy what poet Wallace Stevens called the pleasures of merely circulating. I had a foretaste of that experience on a recent two-wheel tour of my first neighborhood. Until I was 8 years old, my family lived in Layton Park, on the southern edge of Milwaukee's Old South Side. The reason we lived there was generational. My Polish grandparents, John and Mary Gerda, ran a hardware store in the heart of the neighborhood at 32nd and Lincoln from 1915 to 1965. And my father, Art, was the oldest of four kids raised behind the store. When he and my mother, Claire, a farm girl from western Wisconsin, settled in Milwaukee after World War II, it was entirely natural for them to build a little house on South 34th Street, only 8 blocks from the hardware store, and start a family of their own. The Layton Park of Art Gerda's youth had been decidedly mixed. The residents were almost entirely white, but mixed in those days usually had a European connotation. Germans and Poles were almost evenly matched in the neighborhood, some transplanted from the old country, and others born here but still speaking their ancestral tongues. Any business person who hoped to prosper had to have a working knowledge of both languages, and my grandparents were no exception. Fast forward 60 years. My wife Sonia and I lived in Layton Park during the first years of our marriage, just two blocks from the used car lot that had replaced Gerda Hardware. The neighborhood was still largely German and Polish, but what a change was on the horizon. In 1980, soon after we left for Bayview, Latino Milwaukeeans made up less than 3% of Central Layton Park's population. By 2010, the number had soared to 73%, and it continues to grow. The changes go well beyond statistics. Sunday Mass at my grandparents' old church, St. Barbara's, is now said in Spanish. Layton Park Lutheran is now Templo Adventista del Séptimo Día, a Seventh-day Adventist congregation. Tebow and Johnson Funeral Home, where roughly half my relatives made their last public appearances, has become Iglesia Cristiana Palabra de Vida, Word of Life Christian Church. Taverns where my grandfather once bent an elbow now play Spanish corridos on the jukebox, and the occasional Mexican flag waves from the front porch of a bungalow that might have been built with nails from Gerda Hardware. Changing neighborhoods provide a wealth of material for meditations on impermanence, but they also underline a fundamental truth about urban life. Everything is in motion. Neighborhoods are like vessels, like shells, built by one group and inhabited by a succession of others. Each group makes its own memories and then moves on. As pop singer Jewel succinctly put it, everything's temporary if you give it enough time.
John Gerda is a Milwaukee-born writer and historian. He's written 23 books on the history of the city. His most recent one is Brewtown Tales, More Stories from Milwaukee and Beyond. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. And find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, a new analysis finds that the lowest 10% of wage earners gained the most during the pandemic. From 2020 to 2022, wages grew nearly 6% for our lowest income workers, and that's adjusted for inflation. At the same time, but at the end of the pandemic era, government spending and the Federal Reserve's current push to curb inflation may claw some of those gains back. We're talking about wages and whether the increase in income for those who need it most is sustainable. And we'd like to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234. How have your wages changed during the pandemic? And how has inflation impacted your life and your bottom line? 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Tim Smeeting is the Lee Rainwater Distinguished Professor of Public Affairs and Economics at the La Follette School of Public Affairs at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He is also the former director of the Institute for Research on Poverty. And Tim, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks. Thanks for having me, Tim.
So we had a 6% increase for the lowest 10th percentile of wage earners. But at the same time, we saw a 5% decrease for the 90th percentile of wage earners from 2020 to 2022, largely encompassing the worst portions of the pandemic, and that's adjusted for inflation. What happened to wages over that time? What's the cause of this?
Well, that's a good question. A couple of things. First of all, we had a very tight labor market. Demand exceeded supply, and the pandemic wore down, and people wanted to go out. So in particular, restaurants and bars were hard hit. There's wages were too low, and all those people got a boost. But you got to remember, the base was really low, so it's not that big a jump. It still was good, and it still is, but you can walk around this whole city and see restaurants are open Wednesday, Thursday, Friday night, only or limited hours because they can't find workers. At the top, what happened was a little bit of a compositional change because a lot of older, better-paid workers retired and younger workers came in. So that pulls the wages down. It's still a much, you know, better deal.
Is this sustainable? Is this something we're likely to continue to see with a tight labor market?
As long as we have a tight labor market, yes. The good news is that There's a lot of demand for low-skill workers beyond bars and restaurants now. The expansion of infrastructure and construction, putting in all those Wi-Fi lines so more people can work at home and things like that all around the state, those are all offer good jobs for low-skilled people. And the other thing is, however, though, the big problem with all this is there's going to be a lot of cutbacks in child care support. So that's going to make it harder for women in particular, or mothers or fathers, to go out and work, because part of the budget deal is going to end up cutting discretionary spending on programs like, you know, child care support and the WIC program and all of that.
So from your perspective in terms of public policy, what role has public policy played in lifting up the wages of the lowest income earners?
Well, it played a role in a lot of ways. We had a child tax credit for 1 year, a refundable child tax credit in 2021. This was a godsend. It helped low-income parents tremendously. It would be there every month, but then we did away with it. During that period, people didn't stop working. They went out and worked more. They used some of the money they got from the child tax credit to buy child care, and that was subsidized further, too. But that's not to mention the fact that everyone was covered by Medicaid with no questions. So they had health insurance. You had access. You didn't have to find a job that had good health insurance. You were covered. Now that's all going away right now, actually.
Yeah, I was going to ask. So some of the debt ceiling deal that was signed into law over the weekend looks to claw back some of the pandemic relief funds. But how much of those pandemic relief funds are the reason we've seen the lowest income earners seeing more wealth for themselves and their families?
Well, some of it is that clawback. It turns out, pardon my French, we farted a mouse. The whole thing ended up. Not saving a lot of money. The SNAP program, we added more veterans, but we told 55-year-olds you had to work, and by the time the math got done, CBO says we're going to spend more on the SNAP program. We cut the IRS's ability to chase high-income tax cheats, and the CBO says that's going to cost us money because we would have gotten back the return. So really what it was about, unfortunately, is there's a lot of people out there who just do not want to increase taxes in any way, shape, matter, or form. And the fact of the matter is the government can't go on spending 25% of GDP and financing only 18% of it. There's a 7% gap. We have to do something.
But the something has always been cuts. But what you've alluded to now is some of the public policy we've seen in the spending from government during the pandemic is some of the reason those who needed it most found the most during the pandemic.
Absolutely. Now, I mean, we stepped on the gas maybe a little hard, all these emergency income payments or whatever. But those boosted demand. But demand has kept on going.
But so has inflation, though, Tim, and I want to get to that
inflation is still there.
I will ask our guest, Tim Smeeting, professor of public affairs and economics at UW-Madison, but I'll also ask you how inflation has impacted your bottom line at 1-800-642-1234, and we'll continue our conversation about the historic narrowing of the wage gap that we've seen during the pandemic and how that might not last. That's next on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn. And coming up tonight at 6 on 1A Plus with Jen White, is there a future for horse racing in the U.S.? The industry is facing new scrutiny after 12 horses died at Churchill Downs. Belmont Stakes is this weekend. Racegoers, owners, and the experts all weigh in tonight at 6 on 1A Plus. Right now, we're talking about how pandemic-era policies reversed the decades-long trend of a widening wealth gap. Our guest is Tim Smeeting, the Lee Rainwater Distinguished Professor of Public Affairs and Economics and former director of the Institute for Research on Poverty at UW-Madison. Still time for your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or your comments about your economic situation, 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. So, Tim, the impact that inflation has had on our spending ability and our budgets?
It's mixed. It depends on what you buy and where you get your money. Part of it, though, these same low-income workers who've been gaining in terms of salary, we're finding out that if people borrow on credit cards, you're borrowing at 28% and 29% now because they've shoved the interest rates up so high. I think the Fed's going to take a pause next month, and I think they should, to wait and see, you know, how things work their way out. One of the things that's going on is there's a surge of immigrants, people already in the country. We've stopped them at the border in the last week or two. But there's 2 million people seeking asylum in the country who want to come and want to work. And we're making jobs more available to them. And they're taking whatever work they can get. And that means more supply of labor, which lowers prices, lowers wages somewhat. Mm-hmm. But still, demand exceeds supply so much. There's so much chance to move up that people are actively thinking, well, why do I want to work weekends and nights at this bar or this restaurant? I can get a regular day job. I can see my kids. Maybe I can get some childcare. I'll work, maybe I'll go be an apprentice somewhere. I'll do some construction, whatever. And I think that's all good.
With your expectation of the Federal Reserve pressing pause on trying to curb inflation, do you expect inflation to somewhat slow here going forward?
We can hope so. Part of it is oil prices. The OPEC's on its last gasp, and they're holding back. That's part of it. Food prices, too. In the summer, they should ease with more supply and more opportunity. The rental thing is tough, depending on if you're an owner, it's fine. If you've got a fixed mortgage, especially if you got your mortgage before inflation took off. But if you want to buy a house, it's really hard. And so it depends where you are.
And isn't that buying a house the way you build equity?
Well, first of all, first thing you need to do is develop emergency savings. You have to have that. And that's one of the things that child tax credit gave families with kids. There was money you'd have some money for an emergency. The earned income tax credit does that too, but you only get that back in February or March, and then there's nothing more after that. But if you can make sure you don't have to go run that credit card at 29%, or make sure you don't need a payday loan, then you can start thinking, well, maybe we can start saving to buy a house. Maybe we should start saving for retirement. Take that IRA offer or that 401k offer from your employer. That all looks good if you keep working. And, by the way, if you don't have a big student loan debt, which creates other things.
Well, that is a recent story as well, as some student loans are going to have to be repaid here going forward.
It's time to start repaying them.
And that's not, as you see it, doesn't help the economy, fuel the economy?
Well, it hurts it. I mean, the people who can't afford to pay their student loans are people who can't afford other things, too. Mm-hmm. Maybe we'll get some relief, but I doubt it. I think that the Supreme Court is going to tell Congress that if you want to give $500 or $600 million back, you have to pass a law. You can't just do that by fiat.
Tim Smeeting, you're the former director of the Institute for Research on Poverty, and it's a big, broad question, but I would ask you to boil it down. What are the causes of poverty? What creates it in the United States?
In the United States, a lot of different things. One in particular is that earned income isn't enough, particularly for single parents. Two parents have a better chance.
So we're talking about wages. We've been talking about lowest income wages, and the lowest income wages would have it the hardest. But across the board, you're saying that we're not making enough money to alleviate poverty in this
country.
Say
you're making $8 an hour tending bar or something.
No.
Increase it by 50% to $12 an hour.
Still
a
struggle.
That's not enough. Right. That's not enough for one person working full year full time to pull their family out of poverty. You need two people, and then you need to get lucky with having health insurance and finding a place you can afford to live.
You mentioned childcare a couple of times.
Oh, yes. Always childcare. And childcare is one of the things that's really at risk now because we need more appropriations. Biden had plans for expanding childcare, but a lot of that's going to be cut back because it's discretionary spending, which is what the only place that Congress has left. Now, what we should have been doing all along, is not taking Social Security off the table.
What do you mean?
Biden, in his State of the Union address, just said, well, you're not going to do anything with Social Security.
Cuts to Social Security?
Yes, cuts to Social Security. But you have to understand how, okay? You can institute cuts that take place 10 and 15 years out and save money on the budget. What you have to do is increase revenues by raising the ceiling on those rates back to cover 90% of wages and pay well-to-do retirees 10 years out a little bit less. That could have been done.
Okay.
That would have brought those numbers way down.
Tim Smeeting, you talked about the less than minimum wage worker making $8 an hour at a bar and having it bumped up to 50% to $12 an hour and how little impact that might have on the bottom line of that person, their income. But what about taxing the top 10% and what impact that has on their lifestyle and ability in the United States?
That is what we, of course, should be doing. And Biden is trying to do that, but he's not going to get away with it. But. The Trump tax cuts expire next year. Trump gave big cuts at the very top in the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, TCJA, of 2017. In 25 or 26, those expire.
Don't we all benefit from those rates go back up. Those were the arguments that were made, Tim.
Right. Trickle down. Kenneth Galbraith once said, trickle down means that if you feed the horses enough, they'll leave something on the road for the sparrows. That's what trickle down. Building from the bottom up or the middle up is the new thing that Biden is trying to do. And so he's trying to preserve and help the middle class, particularly those, you know, people who borrowed money who didn't get a bachelor's degree afterwards, who went to a for-profit college and ended up with a big bill and no return in terms of earnings. And the infrastructure expansions and that those sorts of spending are really going to help them. We need a lot of people in construction and a lot of people doing applied trades. There's big chances for that over the next few years all over the country.
You're a professor of public affairs and economics at UW-Madison, Tim Smeeting, but I hear a lot of connections between the causes of poverty and public policy, that public policy is what, to some degree, dictates poverty in America.
Yeah. You can't work alone isn't going to do it for, particularly for single parents, for most people.
You couldn't work hard enough to get yourself out of it.
Most poor people work. The vast majority of people who get the SNAP program work. Single parents work more than married parents in our country. It's just that you don't have enough hours and enough wages without some help with child care or something. Imagine you're paying $4 an hour for child care. What's that do to you?
$4 an hour?
Yeah, that's cheap.
So if you were to take public policy to use it to alleviate poverty, what would be Tim Smeeting's top priorities?
Well, first of all, child care. Make child care available. When we did W-2 here, Tommy Thompson had child care available and Medicaid available. So you could go to work, you wouldn't lose, you would get child care support. We need more child care slots for low-income people, more subsidies for child care so they could work, okay?
Yeah.
We need to allow them to move into better jobs. A tight labor market will continue to do that.
Okay.
Move into better jobs.
But that doesn't
sound
like a public policy issue then.
Oh, it is if you can help people get retrained and get ready to do these jobs.
What about health care?
That's a really tough one. What's going to happen is right now a whole bunch of people are being shed from Medicaid. Not so much kids, although if they cut the CHIPS program and other programs, or if they temporarily toss you off and it takes time to get back on, kids are going to have trouble. And we know the youngest kids need health care the worst. They need it. They need those original checkups. They need to know when they're having a problem. They need to be ready to go to school and so forth. And all of that's threatened by this big shuffling that's going on right now. Places like ABC Health in Wisconsin are helping a lot. But some people who are actually eligible will be temporarily derailed from health care. And that's probably going to create a lot more people at the emergency room and a lot more health problems that could have been prevented that won't be prevented.
Hey, Tim, we're out of time, but I want to thank you for spending yours with us this afternoon.
Thanks, Tim. Nice to be with you.
Tim Smeeting is a distinguished professor of public affairs and economics at the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison, talking to us about the historic wage gains made by low-income workers during the pandemic and how likely we are to see that persist. Join us again tomorrow afternoon on Central Time from 3 until 6.